This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
KBOO has been broadcasting live every one of those lectures. We're going to continue for the rest of the series. Tonight's topic, of course, is especially relevant to us as makers of community radio because, well, we are the alternative voice to what you hear in the corporate media. We take very seriously what we do. We are all volunteer-run station. The vast majority of our shows are produced on a volunteer basis. Yeah. We bring you what we bring you because we care about what is out there in the media, and we feel that what is offered to you in the corporate media just does not match the true story. And if I may say so, it's oftentimes an insult to your intelligence.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to remind you, in case you're not aware of this yet, but our spring membership drive is happening starting March 21st, which is just in a couple of days. And you know, if you really like what we produce here on KBOO, you should definitely tune in. We're broadcasting live here on location from the First Congregational Church, downtown Portland. The place is packed. We have a couple hundred people here listening. They came here to listen to John Stauber discussing who controls the media. He will be on stage here just a minute. Actually, our own Lynn Flitch, our station navigator, as she's like to be referred to, is going to introduce John in just a minute. This lecture series is organized by Elohi, which in the Chinook language means earth, ground, land, country, place, or world. The Elohi Institute is a nonprofit organization that provides participants with practical tools for understanding the nature of our home here in the North, the Pacific Northwest, and also for taking care of it. And according to Elohi, most environmental organizations, in response to today's challenges, advocate answers: sustainability, efficiency, resilience, conversation, policies, changes, legislation, and so forth. Well, Elohi actually has a different approach to this. They actually ask question.
Tonight's question is, who controls our media? And here's John Stauber, founder of the Center for Media and Democracy, discussing the issues.
Well, good evening. Good evening and welcome. I'm Peter Schoonmaker, president of Elohi. And I want to thank all of you for coming. I want to thank our board, staff, volunteers, our supporters and sponsors, and I'll just list them off here: Bura Architects, Wyden Kennedy Institute for Sustainable Solutions at Portland State University, Stoll Reeves, Pacific Northwest College of Art, Hot Lips Pizza, Tom Dwyer Automotive Services, Pendleton Woolen Mills, Heathman Hotel, Perkins Coie, the Schnitzer Group, Lazar Foundation, and our media sponsors, Willamette Week, and last but certainly not least, KBOO Radio. And we are right now live on air on KBOO Radio. So audience, be smart, ask good questions. A couple of upcoming events in the Elohi series here at First Congregational Church. Catherine Austin Fitz, who pretty much predicted 2008 back here in 2007, Catherine Austin Fitz, investment banker and political activist, will be speaking about who owns your finances. And Jeffrey Clements, author, attorney, will, and latest book, Corporations Are Not People, will be speaking about who owns your government. So Catherine is April 24th, Jeffrey Clements, May 8th, to finish our series on who owns you. To introduce our speaker, I get to scoot off stage and welcome KBOO Radio's station navigator, Lynn Fitch. Lynn.
Hi, and thank you all for being here tonight. I'd like to thank Peter and Elohi for the opportunity to be broadcasting this live, to be able to bring this kind of information to people who can't be here over the airwaves. Is amazing and tremendous. And I have to tell you that the outpouring of community support for this type of broadcast is great. KBOO has been Portland's community radio station since June 3rd, 1968, when it was that day that we received a telegram from the FCC giving us the authorization to begin broadcasting. At that time, we had a 5-watt transmitter. You know, it's been our mission then for 45 years to meet the needs of the evolving, diverse, and very unique and creative Portland community. And it's been an honor to do so. If you haven't listened to KBOO for a while, I encourage you to turn to 90.7 FM or listen on the web at kboo.fm. This Thursday, our membership drive starts, and it goes through April 6th. So take a listen, join, and become a member, and please vote. As a member, you get to vote, and we would love to have your participation in the upcoming board elections. Now it's my great privilege to introduce John Stauber, who is the guest speaker tonight. John is an independent writer, organizer, and activist. I first became acquainted with John's work when I read Toxic Sludge is Good for You. That was back in 1995. I was managing a pollution prevention program in Anchorage, Alaska for the EPA. That book became my Bible. John has co-authored 6 other books, and in 1993, he founded, let me get this right, the Center for Media and Democracy. So please join me in welcoming John to the stage.
Thank you very much, Lynn. It's wonderful to be here in Portland. I've spent most of the last decades in Madison, Wisconsin. We like to call ourselves the Portland of the Midwest. These days I live off-grid in a really beautiful part of Wisconsin called the Driftless. I retired from Center for Media and Democracy back in 2009 when I realized all I was doing was fundraising and managing, and that wasn't any fun anymore. And I've laid fairly low in terms of writing articles or being any sort of public voice for a lot of the last few years, helped my dad through his final years. And when I got the invitation to speak here at ILAHI and in Portland, I really took it as an opportunity to jump back into the limelight. And in fact, I penned an article that is proving wonderfully provocative and controversial that's in Counterpunch this last weekend that I might talk about a little bit. But I want to thank Peter and Aaron and ILAHI, KBOO, and I want to thank the unknown to me programmer who's given up their station slot tonight so that I can spend this time talking to you. That's a lot of pressure. Thank you very much, and I mean that. I'm going to talk, and anyone who knows me knows I can talk and talk and talk. I'm going to try to talk for just about a half an hour and then go to Q&A. And hopefully in that half hour, I'll hit on some points that some of you might have in the forefront of your mind right now. But let me say that it was interesting to pick up the Oregonian today and look at the front page. I can't claim I've had time to read more than the headlines, but I don't know if your paper's like this every day, but it's a pretty amusing front page. First of all, there's some really shocking news here. Your new ballpark is going to cost more and seat fewer. No surprise there. And also, I'm pretty disappointed in this crowd because it says liberal arts majors in the Portland tax base. Many of the careers favored here don't pay a lot, and that translates to less statewide revenue. You slackers. You slackers. You know, I hope this public shaming gets some of you out working tomorrow. Thank you, Oregonian, for that. What really caught my attention was this article, Breeding Controversy. Opposing sides are preparing for a fight as the legislature takes up bills that would require labeling of genetically engineered foods. This is really why I'm here, because all my life I've been an organizer and an activist, going back to growing up in the 60s in a conservative, pro-war, Republican Catholic family in the hometown of Melvin R. Laird, Secretary of Defense for Richard Nixon, and being wonderfully radicalized by watching Walter Cronkite's Evening News, because it was the only network we got. And in 1967, you know, just the horror of seeing that war unfold in living rooms in a way that the Pentagon has made sure doesn't quite happen again. A war that eventually killed 2.5 million Asians because we needed essentially to pump money into the military-industrial complex and protect the pride and reputation of a line of presidents. Tonight we're here, of course, on the 10th anniversary of the launch of the war in Iraq, sold with a horrific public relations campaign through the American media, despite a majority of Americans smartly opposing that war. The war proceeded as a bipartisan disaster. I'll get into that later. But this whole issue of genetic engineering, genetically engineered foods, this radical idea that somehow you people have a right to know whether the food you're consuming is genetically engineered. I mean, where do you get off? This is really extreme. What I love about capitalism, other than all the cool things I own, what I love about capitalism is that defenders of corporate capitalism will always talk about the primacy of the market and let the market decide, until the market decides something's not a very good idea. And then it's like, well, just don't tell the public. Don't let them choose whether or not they're going to consume milk from cows injected with a genetically engineered hormone. Keep the labels off it. Don't let them know if the food supply is going to be genetically engineered by Monsanto. God forbid they should find out there's been virtually no safety testing, and the tests that have been done have indicated problems. We don't want the market to work. There's no reason for that. But it was 1988 to 1993 that I worked on this issue. I mean, we're talking now about a quarter century ago. And I worked for my friend Jeremy Rifkin and his foundation on economic trends. And I discovered propaganda doing that. I'd bumped into it before, but I really discovered it working with farmers and consumers, animal rights activists, state legislators like Russ Feingold, who was a lowly state senator from Wisconsin then, who in 1988 was leading our Wisconsin effort to see to it that if this stupid product that the Monsanto Corporation and also Eli Lilly, American Cyanamid, and Upjohn were promoting, this genetically engineered hormone that you inject into cows, causes all sorts of health problems in the cows, forces these cows to produce more milk, puts dairy farmers out of business because it lowers their price, and provides a milk that all the surveys, including the industry and government surveys, showed consumers didn't want, because they don't want milk coming from cows injected with a hormone. that if this hormone were to be approved by, then it was the Bush quail, and then it became the Clinton-Gore administration, minimally there needed to be labeling. We knew that, you know, if consumers had a choice in the marketplace, milk from cows injected with a genetically engineered hormone would fail. We knew that because a survey had been leaked to us showing that, you know, the dairy industry, which, by the way, you probably don't know this, but a lot of cheese is made in Wisconsin, that the dairy industry, and we still say on our license plates, America's Dairyland, had spent a fortune of promotional money trying to brand milk and dairy products in the mind of consumers as a pure, natural product. What could be purer than milk? And now, were they really going to just throw all that away so that Monsanto could produce a product that put farmers out of business and gave consumers what they didn't want? Quick answer, yes. And so this really seemed like a slam dunk. I remember Jeremy Rifkin saying to me, when I agreed to go to work for my old friend on this in May of 1988, he said, "John," if you know Jeremy, that's how he talks, "John, this isn't going to last very long. This product is a loser, trust me. We're going to win quick on this." Jeremy was often right, but at that moment he was incredibly wrong. And the reason he was wrong is because what he didn't understand was that the dairy industry wasn't Farmer Jones. The dairy industry was Philip Morris Kraft, the tobacco industry that was the world's largest buyer of cheese. And the idea that they could pay farmers even less for that cheese was a wonderful incentive. The dairy industry had been in partnership since they did this survey with the biotechnology industry. And so they were lined up, and they were full-bore in favor of this. And so one thing that was obvious to me right away was that the U.S. government, the Food and Drug Administration, who had to approve this product because it was a new animal drug and it had to be shown to be safe for animals, which it wasn't, but they approved it anyway, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which is supposedly, you know, in the minds of some people, supposed to be concerned about food quality and protecting farmers, were solidly in the pocket and, in fact, as it turned out, illegally colluding with the manufacturers of this hormone. Well, cut ahead 5 years, it's 1993, and in the fall of 93, I get a call from the assistant to the head of the Food and Drug Administration in the Clinton-Gore administration. A guy I'd gotten to know a little bit because I'd done this massive Freedom of Information Act, and we'd threatened to sue the FDA, and we'd gotten them to back off because of that, this illegal promotional campaign they'd been involved with. And this was the Clinton-Gore administration, right? The head of the FDA when bovine growth hormone was approved was a guy by the name of David Kessler, who's generally considered this great consumer hero and health hero because he took a hard stand against the tobacco industry. But what happened with the genetically engineered food issue was that the milk hormone was just product number one. And as the milk hormone went, regarding safety testing, consumer acceptance, labeling, right to know, thus would go the whole genetic engineering industry, the crops that were waiting behind it, the crops that are now on the market that are in the food supply and are not labeled. So this was a huge issue. And the vice president of the United States at the time, of course, was a fellow by the name of Al Gore, who was vilified by the right for supposedly having claimed to invent the internet, which he never really claimed and never really did and has become sort of a joke of sorts, but who was totally gung-ho, as was the entire Clinton Gore administration, on biotechnology, genetic engineering. When they came in 1992, Monsanto dumped big money into the huge party on the mall for them. And they came through and they delivered for Monsanto and the biotechnology industry. The FDA decided, yes, we're going to approve bovine growth hormone. They did it over the professional dead body of a guy by the name of Dr. Richard Burroughs, an unknown hero who will forever be unknown, but a very brave man whose job it was in the Food and Drug Administration to decide whether or not bovine growth hormone was going to be approved. And Burroughs examined, you know, this church full of studies submitted by the drug companies, Monsanto and the others, and he said, look, we can't approve bovine growth hormone here at the FDA. Your studies show you take healthy cows, you inject them with a hormone, guess what? Lots of health problems, mastitis, bizarre stuff. We're not approving it. Well, Burroughs was out on his butt. The product was approved. And then there was this question of labeling. You know, is the consumer right to know going to be put in place by the Clinton-Gore administration as a precedent on opening up agriculture to genetic engineering? And the answer was no. David Kessler announced that they were going to approve BGH. There would be no mandatory labeling. All milk is pooled together. So, you know, if 1 in 10 farmers is using this hormone, their milk is pooled. The milk comes from cows injected. And as a sop to us and you, the Clinton-Gore administration said, but if individual states want to arrange for some sort of informational label to be put on the product saying this product came from cows injected or this product didn't come from cows injected, that's okay. Well, we'd been anticipating this, and we had a wonderful strategy. The farmers had been organizing their co-ops, demanding that no milk from genetically engineered cows be taken by that co-op, because the farmers wanted to be able to label milk from their co-op. This included farmers in Oregon, all over the country. This milk, don't worry, folks, we pledge to you, comes from cows, not injected. And as consumers, we also had a boycott ready to go. We'd put major grocery stores and dairy companies on notice that if they sold milk from injected cows, we'd be organizing a consumer boycott. We felt pretty confident that although we'd been screwed, I think I can still say that on the air, although we'd been screwed horribly by the Clinton-Gore administration, who went with their biotech friends and were going to approve this, at least they'd thrown us a sop and we are going to be able to have voluntary labeling. Better than nothing. The dairy industry was terrified. The National Milk Producers Federation, which were the biggest milk co-ops in the United States, and that sounds great, a milk co-op, but if you know the dairy industry, these are like Fortune 500 companies, some of them are. They're set up as co-ops, but they're not pro-farmer, they're not pro-consumer, they're part of the massive dairy industry. They went to Al Gore, and they said, we have a heck of a problem on our hands, because our co-ops are under pressure from the people who buy our dairy products and the farmers. They're not going to be able to take this stuff. We need help here. So basically, the help came from the FDA, who at that point stepped forward. I got a little ahead of myself. They'd already said there would be no mandatory labeling and said, oh, by the way, we will let every state decide whether or not milk sold in their state, yogurt, cottage cheese, etc., can be labeled coming from cows that are not injected with this drug, knowing that the state of Illinois and the corporate-supported National Association of State Departments of Agriculture, all our public officials, you know, in this big association supported by the corporations. And Monsanto were ready to go. And Illinois said, not in our state. No dairy company is going to sell a product in this state with any label indicating that it's from cows not injected. And then Monsanto, for good measure, sent out letters to every dairy co-op saying, if you don't accept milk from cows injected, we're going to sue you, from one of the biggest law firms in Washington. And just for good measure, they sued a couple of dairy co-ops. And what happened was it froze. The co-ops buckled. And it wasn't for another year or two before companies like Ben & Jerry's and Stonyfield and others really got the gumption together to ironically defend their much guaranteed and upheld constitutional rights to label truthfully their products. But in that little bit of time, the damage was done. And so today, even today, a quarter century later, on a state-by-state basis, that fight is going on. Monsanto and I guess Eli Lilly now bought up their product, you know, challenging efforts at the state level to simply put labels on dairy products saying it comes from cows not injected. And what I found out was a number of things. I was being spied on. Meetings I was organizing were being infiltrated by consumer activists who were actually working for the PR firms, working for the genetic engineering industry, which stunned me. You know, I'd get a call from some really sincere-sounding person who would say, look, we're moms out in Maryland, and we understand you've got a by-invitation-only meeting of your coalition of farmers and consumers. I guess I wasn't too smart then. I didn't ask, how'd you hear about a private meeting? And we want to send somebody. So they did, and this very nice young woman showed up. And about 2 weeks later, I got a letter, got a phone call from a reporter in Vermont saying, oh, Monsanto's out here in Vermont bragging that they had a spy in your meeting. Any idea who that was? Well, I pulled out the sign-up sheet, which I still have somewhere, and there was her name. And I said, yeah, it's got to be this person. Everyone else knew everyone else. And I said, it's sort of strange, too, because this young woman came, and she spent her time not engaging, but just reading a paperback book, which she stuck up on a table. And I thought, that is weird behavior. And even at the time, when that meeting was over, I thought, that was really weird behavior. I wonder if that book could have been, like, transmitting this meeting. Oh, my God, no. How could that ever happen? You are paranoid. I think that's exactly what was going on. And we blew that out of the water. You know, we exposed that operation. And I began looking at this company, Burson Marsteller, that she worked for. And right about that time, I began to get out of FDA and USDA thousands of pages of documents showing how they were all colluding to overcome consumer and farmer resistance to this. And it was a big aha moment. And I realized this is why we lose. We people who are trying to work on environmental, consumer, human rights, civil rights issues, anytime we're up against, you know, the organized powers that be, they not only own the politicians, they not only own the commercial media, they not only flood the commercial media with advertising, they also hire these brilliant public relations firms. Who knew? That manage and manipulate public opinion, public policy for the powerful. And then as I dove into that, I realized this is what I have to do. This is my next issue, taking on organized propaganda. So 20 years ago in 1993, I founded the Center for Media and Democracy to publish this little quarterly PR watch. And our first issues were exposing firms like Mongovan Bisco Duchin. Whoever heard of them? You know, they were a specialty spy operation that worked to defeat radical change, i.e. the sorts of change we all want. And they did it wonderfully. But luckily, I'd gotten a hold of some of their documents because they were involved working for the biotech industry also. And then In 1994, I got a call from a publisher, Greg Bates, who said, wow, you know, you put out this publication, PR Watch. Have you ever thought of writing a book? I said, yeah, great. Let's do it. So he said, well, we'll give you a little money. You know, you can do a book. People are going to be really depressed because people are depressed enough already. And then you come along and give them reason to be really depressed because you pull back that curtain and reveal the Wizard of Oz. So you've got to come up with some snappy, upbeat ending on how this propaganda thing can be defeated. And then he said, and also, you talk about the public relations industry. That can't be in your title. No one wants to hear about the PR industry because it's boring, it's unattractive. You've got to come up with a jazzy title. The title that my co-author Sheldon Rampton and I came up with was Toxic Sludge is Good for You. And I just blurted it out. I was actually inspired by a Dan Perkins Tom Tomorrow cartoon, I realized later. And Sheldon said, lies, damn lies in the public relations industry. Great, that was our title. And my wife came home and said, you guys are nuts. You can't have a book title like that. And luckily the publisher said, we'll go with it. Well, we're hurrying this book. Did I say I was going to talk for half an hour? Pardon me, I lied. We're hurrying this book. And, you know, we started writing the book in December of 94. And about March or April, I get a call. I love serendipity. And I get a call, and it's this very friendly woman by the name of Nancy Blatt, very perky public relations type, introduced herself and said she was an environmentalist with the Water Environment Federation, something I, as an environmental activist, had never heard of. And by now, I was a little wiser, and I thought, well, that's great. Anytime you hear a great-sounding name, think the opposite. I said, great, Water Environment Federation, what do you do? And she said, well, we're really concerned about clean water, and we're a big organization, and great, great. She said, and we're involved right now in this effort. We know you've got a book coming out in the fall of the year, and that the title is Toxic Sludge is Good for You. And I'm like, really? I think I just came up with that title a month ago. How did you know that? The book's not out. She said, well, we keep track of things. And then she said, you know, we really are concerned about this because we're an environmental organization. Our mission is clean water. And, you know, it's not toxic sludge anymore. It used to be, but it's not anymore. It's now biosolids, a natural organic fertilizer. I thought, whoa, man, life is good. And she said, we're really concerned because we're working with the Environmental Protection Agency. And I'm thinking, oh, very reassuring. And she said, we are very concerned because there's probably going to be a lot of misinformation just in your title. And we're trying to get farmers, everyone's pro-farmer, aren't they? We're trying to get farmers to accept this free natural organic biosolids as fertilizer. It's rich in nitrogen. And we're afraid your book title might scare them away. And she said, have you ever thought of the title, Smoking is Good for You? And I thought, gee, that's interesting. Tell me more. And so when we came up with that title, I thought, oh, great. People are going to think it's an environmental book. Wouldn't it be wonderful if there actually was something like toxic sludge in a PR campaign to tell us it was good for us? And I found out, indeed, there was. And this was the campaign of the sewage industry to take sewage sludge. You know, every one of these wonderful sewage plants that every municipality has, you know, the second biggest public works program in history after the highways, paid for with tax dollars, that takes this horrible stuff, the viruses and bacteria and PCBs and dioxins and probably all that stuff up in Hanford, maybe some of it at least, that ends up in sewage, it concentrates it in this constantly produced growing mountain of sewage sludge. And the EPA had found out this stuff was too toxic to dump in the middle of the ocean, to incinerate, to landfill. Aha. What if we just took it, because there's nitrogen in it, called it fertilizer, or something like fertilizer, biosolids, will jiggle the 503 regulations a little bit, you know those, and we'll say, hey, you can disperse this all over farm fields across the United States. That was the campaign. I'd like to say we put a stop to it, but it's bigger than ever. In fact, now what they do, City of Los Angeles takes its sewage sludge, couldn't be anything bad in there, could it? Takes its sewage sludge, mixes it with wood chips, calls it compost, sticks it in bags, and sells it in stores as natural organic compost. Not certified organic. Please don't get confused when you walk in the store and see the natural organic compost and you find out later, oh my God, I put sewage sludge in my garden. I thought it was organic. Go, well, we meant the other organic, you know, like organic chemicals. Anyway, I could go on. How about a sleep-in tonight? What do you say? Is anyone here from the old Grateful Dead? We'll just get some music going. This is a beautiful church organ. Can anyone play Whiter Shade of Pale on it? I'd like to hear that. So that's been my gig, you know, for the last 20 years, investigating and reporting on propaganda. I am actually going to wrap up right now and get a lot more serious because it was 10 years ago that despite opinion polls showing the American public didn't want this, the Democrats, surprise, surprise, 6 months later, voted along with Republicans to give our illustrious President George Bush permission to attack the country of Iraq, which was done 10 years ago, today or tomorrow, depending on which part of the world you live in, I guess. And it was 10 years ago that another publisher of ours called up and said, hey, we don't normally do this. We were with Penguin by then. But how would you guys like to take the reporting you've been doing on your website and in PR Watch about how this whole war is nothing but a sham and a sales job, whip it into a book and make it the first book that comes out July of 03 exposing this fact? And we said, great. I said, I've already got a title, Weapons of Mass Deception. Let's do it. And Mitch Horowitz from Penguin said, well, I want you to understand, we don't do this. We're Penguin. Your previous book was a hardcover book. We like a long lead time. But we personally think this is important. And we also think we're going to sell a lot of books. So let's do it. He said, but there's just one thing. You have to have this book finished in 6 weeks. We're like, how much money is in it? I forget how much money was in it, because all our books, the six that I co-authored through Center for Media and Democracy, are the property, not of me, but the Center for Media and Democracy. So the money was going to go to the center, which owns the books. He said, I think it was $20,000. He said, we can do it. And then we called the agent and said, great news, we've got a new contract. We've got to produce the book in 6 weeks. We think we can do it. I said, I'll put my co-author on it full time, and we've got most of this pulled together. And our agent, being a very wise guy, in the best sense of the word, said, okay, here's the deal. We're going to negotiate a bonus if you get it done in 6 weeks. And here's the deal. You're not going to do it in 6 weeks. You're going to do it in five, because we're going to get that bonus. And we did. We produced the book in 5 weeks. Weapons of Mass Deception, Uses of Propaganda in Bush's War in Iraq. And as we are wrapping up the book, we are even able to include a couple signature PR events staged. One was the toppling of the Saddam statue, wonderful event. And the other, of course, was the mission accomplished landing on the carrier. And that book ended the book, literally. And then on the back, we laid it out, and the book hit the market July 2003. So remember, we wrote this book knowing about the massive CIA, neoconservative, public relations campaign that the media was involved with to sell the war. We wrote the book totally comfortable with that. We knew there was no connection between 9/11 and Al-Qaeda, as the administration kept insinuating. We were pretty darn sure there were no weapons of mass destruction. But in the book, we said, you know, we'll find out for sure when there are boots on the ground. But remember what was going on back then. The war was started. The spin on this, of course, is the weapons inspectors got out of the country. No, the war was started because the Bush administration said to the weapons inspectors, get your behinds out of the country. Even though it was obvious that, you know, given another month or two, they would probably absolutely nail it down. No weapons of mass destruction program active here. But of course, the Bush administration didn't really care because it was all an excuse to launch a war in Iraq. So our book came out in July of 2003. And surprise, surprise, it was totally ignored by the mainstream media. My co-author and I flew out to New York. That's where a lot of the media hangs out. Our publisher remembers the giant Penguin Corporation, part of Pearson. They put a huge PR push behind the book. They had the book everywhere. And we were on Amy Goodman's show, and it was a lot of fun. And Amy said, well, you know, the book's just out. It's incredibly amazing. I'm sure you've got a whole bunch of other interviews lined up. You came all the way from Wisconsin to New York. We're like, no. No, not one. Danny Schechter's going to interview us for some movie he's doing. And we're being followed around by some French film crew that's doing a documentary. But no, no one interviewed us. And despite that fact, the book flew out of the bookstores. We sold something like 50,000 copies of this book with no publicity except a really nice review in the San Francisco Chronicle, I think it was, that bumped it up Amazon and Amy Goodman. And lots of books had been published, and it just flew out of the bookstores. And it showed up on the New York Times bestseller list. It showed up not at 15 and up, where they print the bestseller list. It showed up just below that. And our publisher, who after all was in this to sell books, were like, oh, great, you're on the New York Times bestseller list. This means they have to review you. Cricket, cricket, cricket. Of course, the New York Times was just flayed in the book because our wonderful liberal New York Times played a critical role in making sure we went to war with this hack journalist, Judith Miller, who took information from what everyone who was doing any investigating knew was this CIA front group started under the Clinton administration with the help of the Rendon firm, Ahmed Chalabi's Iraqi National Congress. And yet the New York Times, Judith Miller, crack investigative correspondent, later media hero for going to jail for something, was just taking this neoconservative pro-war propaganda and being allowed to plaster it across the pages of the New York Times. You know, people like Al Franken, between the New York Times and Colin Powell, you know, his little presentation before the United Nations, you know, even good liberals like Al Franken were literally helping to organize pro-war rallies. I don't know, somehow a couple guys from Wisconsin saw through all that. And in fact, anyone who was paying attention to mainstream media outside this bubble of the United States could figure it out. Because the mainstream media in other countries was reporting this in a fairly even-handed way. But our book, it was killing us, man. They weren't reviewing our book. And the only way to really sell that book was to get the New York Times to say, hey, look, what people are buying and review it, which they never did. It still sold a lot of copies. And then 6 months later, of course, we had this little dog and pony show with, what was his name, David somebody, who was sent over there by the Bush administration to find out what happened to those weapons of mass destruction. And in January of 04, he held a news conference saying, sorry, there aren't any. And the New York Times and everyone else screamed, who knew? Who could have known that? But it really gets worse. And now I am going to wrap up. It really gets worse. I mean, first of all, everything the anti-war movement said, and the anti-war movement, by the way, was you, the majority of people in the country who were opposed to the war, everything they said and knew turned out to be true. No weapons of mass destruction, no connection to 9/11, no connection with Al-Qaeda. What they called Al-Qaeda in Iraq popped up after the war. And it wasn't Saddam and bin Laden together in the hot tub. Those two hated each other. And the war has ended up killing, who knows exactly, I think the best guess is over a million people have died by now because of the war. And what has it accomplished besides destabilizing the region? Well, ironically, the top U.S. foreign policy objective in Iraq had been to make sure a Sunni government friendly to Iran didn't take control of Iraq. I'm sorry, a Shiite government friendly to Iran didn't take control of Iraq. Saddam was a Sunni. Guess what? We put in place a Shiite government. That's what Iraq has. It's a Shiite nation now, friendly to Iran. So there couldn't have been much more of a disaster unless you include the $1 trillion that plus that we're on the hook for. And one more thing I'd like to say is that the war was such a disaster that in 06, the Republicans were defeated. And they weren't defeated because of the brilliance of the Democrats or the strength of the organized anti-war movement. They were defeated because by then the American public had wised up and was sick of the war and voted them out of office. In early 2007, there was a tremendous opportunity to cut off funding for the war in Iraq. The Democrats were only in control of the Congress because of the war. Mario Cuomo told this meeting of the Democracy Alliance, these incredibly rich millionaire and billionaire funders of the Democratic Party, including guys like George Soros, in December of 06, the Iraq war was a gift to the Democratic Party. Because you don't have much more. That's the reason you have the Congress. And so what I call the real anti-war movement really was expecting now that funding would be cut off. But what had happened between 02 and 06 was a professional anti-war movement grew up, especially organized by Move On, which totally campaigned and gained millions of email addresses and subscribers and raised millions of dollars, you know, against the war. And then in 07, the Move On lobbyist, a guy by the name of Tom Matzie, M-A-T-Z-Z-I-E, had a coalition that Move On led with other professional-funded anti-war groups in Washington, D.C., and they gave the Democrats cover, while Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic Congress decided rather than taking a courageous and risky stand of ending funding for the war, which, by the way, is the only way a war has ever been stopped, other than brutal military defeat, somebody cuts off the money. The Democratic Congress gave the Bush administration more money than they wanted because of a cynical ploy, in my opinion, which turned out to be completely true. Well, heck. If, indeed, we could take over the Congress in 06, why don't we just keep this baby going and hang it around the Republicans in 08 and take the presidency? It worked brilliantly. It was cynical. Most people were never aware of it. And I called Move on it. And then today, I wrote an article about it. Today I got an email from Move On bragging about, boy, oh boy, pat us on the back and send us $10. We ended the war, remember? So I republished that online and began getting nasty emails from Move On. Why are you doing this? Because I think truth and facts are important, especially when no one's heard them yet. And now I am going to end this. One last thing. So as bad as all this propaganda campaign that we showed in our book was, it got even worse. In 2008, one of the best investigative reporters in the mainstream press, who's won Pulitzers I lose track of, David Barstow, B-A-R-S-T-O-W, writing for the New York Times, exploded across the pages of the New York Times this unbelievable article about how since 2002, those military experts, the retired admirals and generals who every single network had in 2002 and 2003 and 2004, sort of like sports commentators. Well, it's been a hot day here in Iraq and the home team is scoring big, you know, who were crucial to selling the war because they were now experts just helping the media explain to us doofuses what was going on. It turns out that over 75 of them on every network were working with Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, and George Bush as part of a coordinated PR campaign to sell the war, starting in 02. They had their talking points, their propaganda lines handed to them by the Pentagon and the Bush administration. I mean, imagine this. It's unfathomable. This is the sort of thing that had it become public before the war was launched, it would have been enough to shut down the friggin' attack. But it wasn't until 2008 when it came out. And it was fascinating to watch what happened. Because Barstow's piece, which took up most of the front page of the New York Times and then continued for two full pages within, that had taken him over a year to write, and that luckily, as he told me when I met with him at that time, his paper, the New York Times, had spent lots of money going to court to force these documents out of the government. This story never, ever appeared on ABC, NBC, CBS, MSNBC. The media that most people get most of their information and misinformation and propaganda from, television. The media that sold the war, Fox, forget about them. The media that featured these guys, who, by the way, were now most of them making their living as lobbyists for the military. Hey, great news. You know, we blew up another missile. Score one for my firm. Do I get a commission on that? They were silent. Howard Kurtz, I think, mentioned it on CNN. The alternative progressive media, of course, picked up on it. I actually ended up on the McNeil-Laird NewsHour because, to their credit, they hadn't paid one of these propagandists, although they did use them. And they wanted to get Barstow, but Barstow's an old-school journalist. And he was like, no, I'm not going to get out there promoting the story. So they called me, and I was on, and I debated this guy who began by saying, this is a non-story. I worked in Washington. I was a journalist for ABC. Big deal. We worked with the Pentagon all the time. What's the deal here? And I just said to him, I don't think you even read this story. I don't think you even get it. That was really the only moment that this had on television. And a year later, Barstow won another Pulitzer Prize for it. The story died. It had no legs. Most people don't know this story. No one was ever held accountable. In my opinion, that was illegal under current U.S. propaganda laws. But guess what? The bipartisan Congress investigated and decided it wasn't. Swept it under the rug. So now I am finally wrapping up. I'll be happy to take any questions, comments. I'll talk about anything in the media or the business of propaganda. And just before I do that, I know we're on the radio.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. We just finished listening to a KBOO special live on-location broadcast of the Illihi Lecture, Who Owns Your Media, with John Stauber from, we're here in the First Congregational Church in downtown Portland, part of the Illihi 2013 lecture series, Who Owns You? The last two lectures that we've done featuring Raj Patel and Buck Parker are available archived on the web on KBOO.
KBOO.fm/Illihi2013. That's where you can listen to these. Please also check out Illihi.org. That's Illahee.org for more information about the next lecture. So mark your calendars. Two more lectures coming up. Tune in to KBOO April 24th, 7 p.m. with Christine Austin Fitz. Discuss Who Owns Our Finances. And May 8th, 7 p.m. With Jeffrey Clements, Who Owns Our Government. You can also get tickets to see these live. All lectures take place at the First Congregational Church here in downtown Portland.
And a special thanks to Stu Dodge Sound and Count for providing the some of the audio live from the stage for us. And thank you for tuning in. I'm Jimmy Tardy.
And I'm Del Crescenzo. We're now going to the Melting Pot Silence Dance Special Party.
Compare, shop, try, and buy at the Better Living Home, Garden, and Lifestyle Show, March 22nd through 24th at the Portland Expo Center. This show will introduce you to businesses and groups in our region that can help you make positive and responsible consumer choices. They'll cover renewable resources, electric transportation, and other ways to leave a smaller footprint on our earth. It's the Better Living Home, Garden, and Lifestyle Show, Friday, March 22nd through Sunday, March 24th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/betterliving2013.
KBOO Community Radio turns 45 this year, and our first 2013 membership drive starts on the 21st. Help make reaching our $99,000 fundraising goal a little easier by offering a matching donation of at least $500 for us to use on air during the drive. Matches are really great motivators to entice our non-contributing listeners to donate, so please email membership@kboo.org if you would like to offer a match or have any questions. Or call 503-231-8032 and ask for the membership department to plan your spring drive matching gift today.
Starting Thursday and continuing every day of our spring membership drive, it's KBOO's Vintage Poster Contest. Each morning at 7 a.m., we will post a new image of a historic KBOO event poster on our website, kboo.fm. You'll have until 3 p.m. that same day to enter the contest for a chance to win the only other known copy of the poster. See the art and enter the contest at kboo.fm. Only one entry per person per day. Spread the word about KBOO's poster contest. Anyone can enter. Scanning and reproduction services for KBOO's poster contest provided by Technical Imaging Services located in Portland's Old Town.
Have you heard about the Melting Pot Silent Mobile Dance Parties?
Silent dance. Doesn't sound very fun.
Actually, it's a lot of fun. Picture 200 people dancing with headphones to the same music. The Melting Pot Radio Show will have a series of silent dance parties from 8 to 10 p.m. Tuesdays in Portland parks and public spaces. That's Tuesdays from 8 to 10 p.m. For more information and this week's location, go to kboo.fm/silentdanceparties. Doing it in the park. Doing it after dark. Oh, yeah. Concrete park.
90.7 FM, KBOO. The time is 8:02 on the KBOO clock, which means it's time for another edition of The Melting Pot. And tonight it's one of these special evenings. It happens to be the 19th, which is going to be the second of our silent dance parties. Tonight it's going to be happening over at Irving Park, which I believe is 15th and Fremont, or pretty close to there. Once you get there, there are a couple basketball courts. One is lit up under a big cover, probably about room for 200 or 300 people there. So we got people showing up already. It should be an incredible time. Going to start you off with some slow music to get you stretched out. This is new from Plantre, dropped yesterday on Attic Tech. The name of this track is called Taiga Bone. And we will be back with more information on that. Wanted to let you know that this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from True West, presenting two evenings with Grateful Dead tribute band Dark Star Orchestra, Thursday, April 18th, and Friday, April 19th, at the Crystal Ballroom. Tickets and information for Dark Star Orchestra at CascadeTickets.com and the Crystal Box office. So like we said, we're going to be getting into this track from Plantre. He just dropped a 4-song EP, and he is a longtime fan of the show. First met him answering phones for The Melting Pot about 2 or 3 years ago, and his production has really taken off. If you want to support him, you can check it out on Bandcamp. You can also follow the links on my Facebook or give a call down here, 503-231-8187. Irving Park is the place that you want to be tonight if you want to get down with the silent dance parties. If you don't know about them yet, people have been collecting old Walkmans and teaming up with some headphones and joining in parks and public spaces to be able to have a dance party that no one can really break up. There's no sound ordinance that we're bothering, and so it's just a bunch of good people there with their own Walkmans having a really good time. We had a great time 2 weeks ago. There was a little bit of rain then, but it didn't really seem to affect people. So if you're out there in your car or you live close to Irving Park, definitely head down there and show your support for KBOO. I believe that we're going to have some video screens down there tonight to add some other elements. Got a bunch of great